The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Everyone, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia at Home. Thanks so much for joining us. My name is Dina Halick, and I'm the head of the Central Fiction Department at the Free Library of Philadelphia. So tonight, I am thrilled to welcome one of my favorite authors to her first, and hopefully not her last, Free Library of Philadelphia event. Shauna McGuire is the author of the October Day, an encrypted urban fantasy series, the Wayward Children urban fantasy series. She writes Ghost Spider for Marvel Comics, and under the pseudonym Mira Grant, she writes scientific horror, and she has brought her kitten. So you now are not listening to me. She also publishes a short story every month on Patreon. She was the winner of the 2010 John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, and in 2013, she became the first person ever to appear five times on the same Hugo ballot. Her novella, Every Heart a Doorway, received the Nebula, Hugo, and Locust Award for Best Novella. And this year, Middle Game is nominated for a Hugo Award for Best Novel, and the Encrypted series is nominated for Best Series. So I am gonna let Shauna take it away, and I will come back in about 15 minutes and we will start a discussion. Take it away, Shauna.
So this is actually not my kitten. This is my mother's kitten, Tinkerbell. But she has been hanging out with us a lot here during quarantine. It is lovely to virtually meet you all. We are all gathered in the little Free Library of Philadelphia, which is a city I have not been to terribly often, where I genuinely wish we all were physically right now. Elsie, please don't come over here to eat the kitten. Elsie, my adult Maine Coon, is now stalking toward us because she thinks that the kitten is a tasty snack. Thank you all for joining us. I hope you do have questions for us tonight, because otherwise they'll just make me talk for the entire hour. And I don't know why I continue to behave as if they were standing behind me with a cattle prod, which would normally be the case in an in-person library event where they can get to me. Because here, as you can see from the incredibly sophisticated and professional background that I'm in, I am in my bedroom, safe in sunny, unfortunately so for the last several days, Seattle, Washington, which is where I live and work. And this has been a trying time for all of us. You know, people talk about wanting to go home to the lockdown, to work from home, and find new levels of productivity that they've never experienced before, to do more and create more than they ever have. But what they don't realize or don't want to admit to themselves is that we're not just working from home, we are working through a crisis. This is the sort of experience that none of us have had before in our lives. There are some people who were old enough to remember the 1918 flu pandemic, but there aren't very many of them. And for the most part, people who have experienced any pandemics at all in this modern age are members of the CDC, Doctors Without Borders, or the Epidemic Investigative Service, who chose to go into spaces where a major outbreak was going on. We haven't had anything global like this in a very long time. So we are all experiencing a collective trauma. And that's why right now it is incredibly important that we be kind to ourselves and kind to each other. And if you're not getting the amount of work done that someone says you ought to be, unless that person is literally your boss and responsible for you paying your bills and being able to eat, you don't have to listen to them. Don't look at somebody like me and say, oh, she wrote two books during lockdown, I'm a failure, which I'm seeing from all different stripes of the world, creatives and non-creatives alike. And there are now two cats investigating each other behind my head, which is great. Tinkerbell and Elsie are friends, so I'm not super worried that they are about to scalp me, but I am a tiny bit concerned about the melting kitten. That's super fun. I'm also, fully melting kitten. Hello. Can I help you in some way? You're thinking about it. Can I help you? I do appreciate you taking time out of your lives, which if they're anything like my lives, are currently a busy rondelay of watching things on Hulu and rereading your favorite books to join us tonight, especially since you have no idea what bullshit I'm going to say. My Instagram live stories frequently devolve into trying to talk people through having panic attacks, which can be a useful technique, but is not fun for everybody. And this is a little odd for me right now because I'm used to more of a rolling scroll of what's going on. And I do understand that Dina is collecting everyone's questions and will happily be answering them once our 15 minutes of babble is up. But right now, just be kind to yourselves. Do what makes you happy. Look for things that will continue to make you happy. It is important to continue experiencing at least some novel input. If you're like me, then right now you don't want anything new. New episodes of very familiar shows might be acceptable, but you may also find days where they are not, and find that you are rewatching TV shows and rewatching movies and rereading old favorite books. There is nothing wrong with that, but try to take a day a week where you do go a little bit outside of that forming comfort zone and experience a new book by a favorite author, or look for a new favorite author by reading something new that you haven't encountered before in a genre you know you enjoy. It's okay to stick with things that you already know will make you happy, but one of my concerns is that coming out of this, we will have lost some of our ability to enjoy novel things. And the human brain is bad enough at novelty to begin with that losing that enjoyment is not great. You're on my hair, you know. No, you don't know, and you wouldn't care if you did, because you are a cat. So that is super fun. You know, oh, people are starting to ask questions, which is great. I am happy to have y'all ask any questions you care to, and I am happy to answer them honestly. Though, please be sure that you ask a question you actually want the answer to. I don't think it would make anyone as happy right now as we might think it would to ask what my actual opinions on the science behind COVID-19 are, or something like that. That's a little stressful and not super pleasant. Hi, Tinkerbell. Hi. Yes, you don't like being scruffed. Well, I don't like you melting off the chair. Yes. You are very liquid. She is very good. I am very fond of my cats, and now she is looking at you, which is great. I enjoy my desk. This is the desk that I work from, which you mostly can't see, and that's a good thing, because there are personally identifying items on here, like prescription bottles and my checkbook and things that I don't necessarily want to broadcast to the entire internet, but there are also a great many toys, and I enjoy my desk toys. I know some people who can't have desk toys at all because they're like, well, I would just play with it all day. This is an Emma Frost Orbs. I think they're made by Funko. Yep, they are made by Funko, and they're just highly stylized versions of Marvel characters. And while I enjoy looking at Emma, it makes me happy to see her and know that she is here. I'm not sure how bored you would have to be with your work to look at this little round person and think all I should do all day is play with that. Tinkerbell is a much greater danger when it comes to wanting to play with that. Dina did mention that I am up for actually 3 Hugo Awards this year. I am up in the best novel category for Middle Game, where I desperately hope I'll win. You're not supposed to really like want it. You're supposed to be say it's an honor to be nominated, which it is. It is a genuine honor to be nominated, but then you're not supposed to admit to wanting to win. I want to win desperately. I have never won a best novel Hugo. This is my 5th nomination in that character, but in that category, my first nomination under my own name. And I am just so proud of this book, y'all. It took me 10 years to get good enough to write. This is the culmination of every trick and technique I have learned as an author. And I'm a little concerned that it'll be 10 more years before I can pull out something else like Middle Game. But so I'm nominated for Middle Game and Best Novel. I'm up in Best Novella for Come Tumbling Down, which is the latest book in the Wayward Children series, which started with Every Heart a Doorway. And I'm up in Best Series for Encrypted. And Best Series is a relatively recent development in the Hugos. It's the latest fiction category to be added. I have appeared in that category every year since its inception, and I have not yet won. And I do think that some people, I have had a couple people say to me, you really were my favorite series this year, but I didn't vote for you because I know you'll get nominated again. And it's like, well, you never know that. It's not a thing you can safely count on ever for anyone. I would really like to win. I feel like urban fantasy, which is where a lot of my work is located, is one of the few genres that that shows itself best. It shows the quality of the genre best in that long series form, in 6 or 7 or 8 or 12 books, however many. And unlike epic fantasy, which is the other subgenre that does best in long series form, it is very frequently overlooked come awards time because it's commercial fiction. It's light and fluffy, and it doesn't take itself seriously. So it would be nice to win a Hugo Award for my pure urban fantasy. And that's been very exciting for me. Middle Game also won the Alex Award this year, which is given out by the American Library Association for adult work with relevance to young adult audiences. And it is the third of my books to win an Alex Award, making me the first 3-time Alex Award winner ever. And I am very grateful to have won for Middle Game, because the second time I won, which was for Down Among the Sticks and Bones, was the day before Alice died. And as I'm sure you can tell from looking at me, I take my cats very seriously. You know, they are a big part of my daily life. They are a big part of my decision-making process, and they are very, very important to me. And so winning an award and then having my beloved cat die did not necessarily mean that I gave that award the level of reverence and excitement that it honestly deserved. So I'm very glad that I got another shot at loving and enjoying the Alex Awards. They are great. Though thanks to the pandemic, they haven't sent out the physical Alex Awards yet for 2020. So I have yet to receive my Alex, and thus it looks like I'm making things up when I say, when I point at the trophy case and say, oh yeah, no, there are 3 of those. No, there aren't. There are 2. There are 3. One of them is just virtual right now. There are 2. 2. 2 Alex Awards. So hopefully my third will show up soon. My trophy case is actually a former display case from Borderlands Books, which is the bookstore that you can support by clicking that buy link. And if you already have Middle Game and Imaginary Numbers, or you're not interested in those books in specific, you can also contact them directly. They have both email and phone links on their website. And Borderlands is happy to mail anywhere in the world. They do charge more for international shipping, but not as much as some places do. And they have more signed books and rarities of mine than anyone else. So that's great. They are my favorite bookstore. They were my local bookstore for a very long time. And I still go out there about twice a year to do book events. We will probably not have an in-person book event for a Killing Frost at this point, just because I'm not sure the world will be unlocked by that point. Yes, hello. Little sleepy thing, you know, sleep. Here comes Dina. Hi, Dina.
Hey, Shannon. How are you doing? It's like as if I haven't seen you for 15 minutes. We have 28 questions already.
Good plus, for us.
Plus the ones that I wrote myself. So I think we're going to need all the rest of the time to go through everything. There is one that has the most amount of votes. I have wondered about this as well, as how do you balance working on all your different projects at once? How do you write something new while you're working on revisions for another?
I mean, part of it is compartmentalization. I'll tell people it's like watching 2 different TV shows at the same time. Right now, we are rewatching Fringe. It's my 6th trip through the full series. We've just started watching Top Chef season 1 on Hulu. And we're watching new episodes of What We Do in the Shadows as they come out. So switching between projects, I don't do it mid-thought, as it were. I'll hit word count on project A, then move to project B, whatever that entails for the day. And it's like finishing an episode of a TV show. You just get to that stopping point and you say to yourself, okay, this is where we finished, and now we're going to move to the next show in the queue. As to how to determine what gets how much time or effort at any given moment, that is largely founded on deadlines and when things are due and when I have to turn them in. You know, if something has 6 months before it has to go to the publisher, it's going to be a little further on the back burner than something that is due in only 6 weeks. Though there, I have to make sure I understand how much I potentially could work on each thing per day, just because otherwise that 6 month project could turn into a 6 day project with no work done.
What is, how long does it take for you to write a novel?
Well, that is a very wide range. The longest first draft ever took 10 years, and the shortest first draft took 6 weeks. So there's a lot of space in the middle there. My usual carrying speed these days is about 40 days of concerted work from the opening of the file to writing the end for the first time. After that, everything becomes very nebulous because I need outside eyes to look at things, give feedback, give editorial notes, tell me what needs to be fixed, because you're too close to the text to see it.
Right. It's always, you never see like that one glaring thing that your beta reader sees, right?
Yep. Or you have to see it from somewhere external. You know, I had a literal revelation about one of the characters in the October Day series while I was watching Hellboy 2 in the theater. I started crying. And when the person I was with asked me what was going on, my response was, "Evening has the wrong hair color." And then I went home and rewrote the book. And that actually was more important than it sounds. But I had somehow missed it until something outside of me made me see it.
Okay, that's a book recommendation question. We'll take that towards the end. Here's one. We're going to go kind of pandemic light here. Let's see, who is this? Sarah asks, I've been rereading Newsflash, one of her favorites. Thank you for writing it. And her question is about Disney after The Rising. Are they still making animated princess films? If so, what are they like? What else are they doing in the animation world? This question is brought to you by the Bambi reference with Sean and George.
At this point, this long after The Rising, yes, they have resumed making animated princess films. They've gone a little bit deeper into the Grimm fairy tales and all of that to make sure that they're mining stories that don't have animal companions. The cuddly animal companion is much less of a part of the Disney formula than it used to be, because even though they are setting their movies in magical worlds that don't have this zombie pandemic to live with, people are still going to view them in the context of the world where they grew up. You know, the schema of the story is still going to fit the cultural background of the kids. So something like Tangled, where you have Maximus, the horse, just kicking around, being well above the size for amplification, that is not going to make little children very comfortable. And so they've had to retire a surprising amount of the old Disney canon because it involved these larger animals that terrify children who were born after The Rising. As for what else is going on in animation, there's probably a lot more movies like the Trolls movies, where everything is very small and is not human. Cute bugs and fish are a lot more popular because everybody knows that mammals can't carry Kellis Amberley.
For those of you who aren't aware of this series, the basic premise is there is a pandemic and it turns people into zombies and animals.
Yeah, anything mammalian can and will be infected, and anything that weighs over 40 pounds can become a zombie. So like my cats could not become zombies, but your neighbor's golden retriever probably could.
If you are in a frame of mind to read pandemic books right now, some of you are, some of you are not. I am in the not camp right now. The Rising series is amazing. Starts with Newsflash series, sorry. The Rising is the actual pandemic.
Yeah, The Rising is the omnibus that they put out. Right. Though I recommend reading them in the individual form, which is Feed, Deadline, and Blackout. In part because if you are someone that has any issues with your hands, The Rising as a collection weighs like 10 pounds. You could use it to kill a man. So the individual books are much more manageable.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go on to another book that you have written under Mira Grant, just because I want to know the answer to this one, is what do we have to do to get your publisher to let you write a sequel to Into the Drowning Deep?
So Into the Drowning Deep is my mermaid horror novel. And I realize that that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but I consulted with upwards of 20 marine biologists from all over the world, came up with biologically feasible mermaids, and then fed people to them. And Into the Drowning Deep was published by Orbit Books under the Mira Grant byline in 2017. It performed really well, so I don't honestly know why, but they elected not to take the sequel at that time, Out of the Swallowing Sea. Now, tweeting to Orbit does not do a lot of good because the Orbit Twitter feed is monitored by people who I know would like to see the sequel happen. So the best way to actually encourage them to publish the sequel is to write to them, either email or physical mail, and say, hey, I am such and such person. I would really like to read the sequel to Into the Drowning Deep. Do you think you could buy it from Mira? And the main reason you need to say it and not me is not because you are in charge of making sure I get to write everything I want to write, but because when I say that people want to see this book, it's like a kid saying, mommy, daddy told me I could have a cookie. You're really not sure. You want to verify.
I know that you've said that you are not interested in self-publishing, but you are doing Patreon fairly successfully. I know I subscribe to it, where you people pay a small amount every month and we get short stories, and in the higher mm-hmm. tiers we get more stuff. Would you consider doing something on that side, or like a Kickstarter, or is that too much self-publishing?
So the reason that I'm not pro self-publishing for me is that there is so much work involved in successful self-publishing that is neither in my wheelhouse nor something I am interested in learning how to do. The Patreon stories, they don't have cover art. They don't have production costs. I don't have to worry about making sure that they are available in other formats. You know, there are no audiobook versions of them. There are no print editions of them, unless you're talking about the chapbooks, which I am historically terrible at getting printed in a timely fashion. To do true self-publishing, you have to be able to make your work available on a variety of platforms, and you have to take on a whole lot of jobs that I have happily outsourced to my publisher and would not be able to take on if I wanted to at this point, because I have so many other books that are committed through traditional publishing. There just aren't the hours in the day to both be finishing the encrypted book that I'm writing right now and doing the editorial on the next issue of Ghost Spider and October Day Book and prepping a book for self-publishing. I have occasionally considered writing something longer and releasing it in installments on my Patreon, but I would pretty much have to create a whole new tier for that, because it's not fair to my patrons to expect that everyone who's there is completely interested in getting 6 installments of a mermaid horror novel for the next 6 months. And that not everyone, I know, but that starts getting us to questions of how much work can I actually do? And the novel that I have under contract already, plus my Patreon story, plus usually one short story a month, is about my workload. Patreon is amazing. It has literally saved lives in this household. It has literally made it possible for us to move here and settle. I would be lost without Patreon. It does not pay my bills as much as the traditional publishing contracts I have do. So I can't afford to be like, oh, well, fuck traditional publishing. I'm just on Patreon from now on, because Patreon could also go away tomorrow. So I have to keep in mind that while art is a beautiful thing and it feeds the human spirit, the body does not do well without the occasional brick of cheese.
Got it. Okay, here we have, I mean, I have to say, I'm terrified of going into the ocean now from reading
That's
Into
fair.
The Drowning Deep. And for those of you around Philadelphia, I actually did a book talk for that one yesterday, which is on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/Philbrick Hall, PHILBRICKHALL. Just plugging myself there. But I don't read horror. This is like one of those, well, I don't like this, but this book, oh my God. This one, An Alien Echo, just got me. Mira Grant did an Alien Universe tie-in novel for teens called Alien Echo, which I read last year. And, well, now I'm afraid of going to other planets, but the ocean is a little closer to be afraid of.
Yep.
Okay, so, is it? Yes. When you were starting out, which books or authors did you read and say, how did they do that? And I want to do that. Which ones still make you say that?
Yep. I really love Stephen King. He is absolutely a meat and potatoes author. He writes to be as accessible as possible to as many people as possible. But when you start stepping back and really looking structurally at his work, he is doing some incredibly smart things. His use of language is very precise. He uses a whole lot of literary techniques so subtly that you don't even realize they're there until they suddenly smack you. I've reread It probably about 40 times over my lifetime. It is the book I have read the most times. And I still find something new every single time I go in there. Robin McKinley does a whole lot of fairy tale retellings, and she will take fairy tales that I think are just irredeemably awful. There is no way you can make anything good out of that.
And Deerskin.
Deerskin is one of my favorite books. Deerskin is actually the book that I point to when people claim that I am trying to ban all sexual assault in fiction. Not only do I not have the authority to ban things in fiction, I wouldn't because of that book. If for those of you who haven't read it, it is a book where the plot literally hinges on sexual assault, but the sexual assault is structurally necessary. It's load-bearing. It's not just thrown in to make you realize that someone is a terrible person. It is part of making the structure of the story go. It is not gratuitous in any way. It is genuinely earned and backed up by the text itself. And once it happens, it is not eroticized. And up until that point, all of the fictional rape I had encountered had been written by male authors, usually in horror, and it was always very erotic. You know, this poor character is being raped and the author is focusing on how her breasts are moving or something like that. And Deerskin, it's just matter of fact, it's a brutal assault. It's not comfortable. It's not a pleasant book to read, but it is beautifully handled in one of those ways that makes you go, okay, we can't ban specific subject matter. We can just say that we wish people would handle it better. And The Last Unicorn by Peter Beagle. That really is the book where if I can make one person feel the way The Last Unicorn made me feel the first time I read it, I have won. I'm done. Like, I did what I set out to do and I'm finished.
Nice. Okay, somebody, Ari, asked a question, which I'm not going to be able to pronounce, even though I have read the pronunciation guide, so I apologize ahead of time. This is an October Day question. You know where I'm going with this on the pronunciation thing, right?
How it did rhymes you come with up? Love Shack.
It rhymes with Love Shack?
Yep, Lushak. It rhymes.
Lushak. Okay. That is not how it is spelled, people. L-U-I-D-A-E-G. How did you come up with the characterization of Lushak, and how did you develop the background on each firstborn?
Well, each of the firstborn goes through a fairly lengthy process of how would you become the kind of person that founded whatever descendant race. For those of you that don't read the October Day books, everyone in Faerie is descended from some combination of Oberon, Mab, and Titania, the king and the first two queens. Their children are known as the firstborn, and they are slightly less powerful than their parents, but are still terrifying. And then the firstborn, each eventually creates a descendant race of fairy, which are basically distinct species, but they are called races of fairy, both because I was still working from that D&D model where everything's a race, which frankly is a tiny little bit racist, but that's where we were when I was starting this series, and because they can all interbreed. You know, they are genetically compatible with one another, so they're clearly not as different as they seem. And each of the firstborn will eventually give rise to a descendant race that can be very different than anyone else's. And so the question is, what kind of parents would these people be? You know, what kind of values would they inculcate in their children? What would they say was important to focus on? And I build them out from there. The Lushak herself was basically it's what my friends at Sorting Hats Chats would call a burned Hufflepuff. She's what happens if you take someone who prioritizes family above everyone else and you just systematically destroy her for centuries. How messed up can you make this person? And that's the Lushak, and she is not living her best life.
Okay. Would your own door lead to a fantasy world or a sci-fi world or something else? This is a Wayward Children's question.
My own door, if I found it, would lead to someplace very personal, which I generally do not disclose to people, but I think it is safe to say without crossing that boundary that it would lead to a world very much like the Moors. I would not go to a fluffy fantasy world. I wouldn't know what to do with it, and they wouldn't want me anyway.
Aw, someone after my own heart. Alex, I love the girl in the green silk dress. Would you be interested in writing more full novels from the perspective of the Encryptids in your Encrypted series?
Well, Alex, if we were actually in a room together and I could see your face to know whether or not I was hurting your feelings, this is where I would lightly mock you, because the title of the book is The Girl in the Green Silk Gown. Rose actually predates the rest of Encrypted in terms of her fiction. So Sparrow Hill Road was a collection of stories that I had written prior to the publication of Discount Armageddon. And that has allowed me to start this sub-series, which is the Ghost Roads books. I don't know whether any other non-Price characters will get their own novels. I would love to, because if you spend 30 seconds in my presence, you realize that I would love to write everything. I'm the girl who spent half of college writing novel-length fix-it fix for Disney Channel original movies, because I just couldn't leave the story where they had left it. So I want everyone to have their moment in the spotlight.
Alex appreciates being mocked, by the way.
Oh, good. Yay!
Has your DDR machine search improved since this morning? This is like all inside jokes for people who follow you on Twitter.
I have mostly been saying on Twitter that people should come and be here. I don't want to say it in writing until money has changed hands and delivery has been arranged. But as of this afternoon, I possibly have less money, more DDR Extreme Mix 2. I found a place that is willing to, they are relatively local. They have not been doing well with the shutdown. And I feel a little bit like an asshole for taking advantage of that. But they are looking to sell off some machines. And they have the correct DDR mix. So if this comes through, I will be posting a link to the Zoom meeting as soon as the machine gets here, so that when I put in Captain Jack for the first time, everybody can shout, "Ayo, Captain Jack," and life will be good. So maybe.
Oh, congratulations. Hopefully, potentially.
Hopefully, potentially, fingers crossed.
Yeah, yay. Follow her on Twitter to find out if it actually happens. Will we see Christopher's World in Wayward Children series? This is from Christy. He's her favorite.
I love Christopher too. So the current contract on Wayward Children goes through book 8. Book 6, which comes out in January, is another portal fantasy. And it follows a girl named Reagan, who you have not met yet, in her time in the Hooflands. Then book 7, because remember they alternate, the odd numbered books are modern day and the even numbered books are flashback. Book 7 will actually be a direct follow-on to Come Tumbling Down, and I'm not allowed to say very much about it yet, but you will get to find out what is happening to Cora in the aftermath of Come Tumbling. And then we have Book 8, which will be a flashback book. It'll be a portal fantasy book. And what happens in that is going to depend partially on what my editors say, because they do get a vote on who we focus on from book to book. I don't honestly know if I want book 8 to be Christopher. I really want to go to Mariposa and let us see the world that he went to. But I am not completely sure that I can write a believable romance between a boy who is dying of cancer and the literal skeleton that he falls in love with. I think it is easier on me as an author and possibly on you as a reader, because suspension of disbelief cuts both ways. If we pick up with Christopher after his time at the school, when he gets to go back to Mariposa, already in love with the skeleton girl, I think that that will be a much easier sell for both my sanity and your enjoyment of the book. So I hope so.
Okay. And I'm going to ask another Wayward Children question from Seraphim. What was it like to write characters with very differing gender expressions and sexualities in the Wayward Children series?
So if you've seen Nanette by Hannah Gadsby, there's a point where she says that her gender identity is represented in the form of a nap. And that is fairly accurate to me as well. Like, my gender identity is exhausted and tired of this conversation, but aware that it is much more important to a lot of other people than it is to me. You know, I've never had a very strong sense of gender. I identify as cis mostly because my pronouns are she, her, and I am firm on that. And I don't want to be that jerk who's like, oh, no, I'm not cis, but you still have to call me she, her, which it's not a jerk thing to do if that's your real identity. But I am just visible enough in terms of profile that I feel like it would be an unfair burden on non-binary people who do not want gendered pronouns. So writing people from a variety of different gender expressions is no more of a challenge for me than writing a variety of people who are different than me, because I don't have a strong opinion there to get in the way. And that helps. Like the Wayward Children books, I just talk to people who do have strong opinions constantly. And that is why you get characters like Cade, who, because of his specific gender identity, which is modeled after a friend of mine who consulted on his creation, because of his specific gender expression, is going to have to be the last of the flashback books I write. Because he is very much a man. He is a trans man who didn't always know. And so the friend that he is based on will say to you, with all sincerity, that when he was a girl, he believed X or Y. And I know that I'm a cis author. I'm very aware of the responsibility of being a cis author writing trans characters, and of the tendency of cis reviewers to prioritize my work above the work of actual trans authors, even though it's not my lived experience. So I have to be doubly careful to be responsible, because I can't just be a little bit careless and think it'll be fine. And so Cade has to wait until we reach the point where readers will not chuck the book across the room as soon as they see a mention of a little girl named Katie, which would be completely reasonable, because in 90% of trans characters, that would be both misgendering and dead naming. But for the actual Portal adventure that he took in Prism, when he went to Prism, he truly believed that he was a little girl. And so his truth is not that straight up standard truth.
If you can write in any franchise aside from one that you already have written in, what would it be?
Doctor Who.
Nice. You didn't even need to think about that one, did you?
Well, if you hadn't added the codicil of aside from one that you've already not written in, because I want the X-Men so badly. I got 6 issues. 7 issues all told of different X-Men adjacent things. And I want the X-Men so badly. That is one of the first fandoms of my heart that is home to me. And it hurts my soul not to be doing that. I'd also really love to write for My Little Pony. Ah, oh, hi, Mom.
Come on, baby.
My mom come to collect her kitten. I just didn't hear her come into the room. So she startled me when she started making kissy noises at the kitten. Okay. Gonna go. Everybody say goodbye to Tinkerbell.
Bye, Tink.
Bye-bye. Okay, but yeah, Doctor Who. If I could write any franchise that I haven't written in before, it would be Doctor Who.
Why?
Because that is the show that taught me how to read. I started watching Doctor Who when I was 3 years old. I'm literally wearing a Doctor Who t-shirt right now. Like, that is... It is the show I grew up with. It is a show I truly love. And, when we got Amy Pond and the whole story of the girl who waited, and she's talking about how long she waited for the Raggedy Doctor to come back to her. Well, the length of time Amy spent waiting is the length of time I spent in the real world with no new Doctor Who on the air. They actually did that on purpose, that the gap between him leaving her and him coming back was the same as the gap that those of us who were children watching Doctor Who in old Who experienced before new Who came.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and
so I want those children.
Doctor Who is always going to be home. It always has been, and it always will be. And I am so baffled, honestly, by people who watch the new episodes and go, "Oh, this is preachy. Oh, this is not for me." Like, did you watch any old Doctor Who, like, ever? Do you remember the Happiness Patrol? Seriously, come on. But Doctor Who is meant to be for everyone. And sometimes that does mean that you don't like the Doctor because it's not your Doctor. My Doctor is 7, Sylvester McCoy.
Oh, I can ask.
Yeah, I will love him forever. He is my professor. And if he showed up in the blue box, I would be gone like that.
See, I was Tom Baker, but now I'm Chris Eccleston.
Oh, Chris Eccleston got done so dirty, and I love him so much. His doctor
and the Patrick McGann audio adventures, the Eighth Doctor audio adventures, are fabulous. Yes.
Paul McGann as the Eighth Doctor made me so happy in the TV movie. The TV movie is shit, but he is a wonderful doctor.
True on both those counts, yes. Okay, we're going to not talk about Doctor Who for the rest of this, although we very easily could. And we're going to go to something a little bit ridiculous, which is if your cats could read, Annette, what? And six people voted for this. If your cats could read, what books would they like?
I'm pretty sure that Meg would read children's books aimed at like first graders because, and you can see her there in the background. This is Megara. She is the most profoundly stupid mammal you will ever meet. Sometimes she gets into fights with shadows and loses. She is not clever. And then Thomas, who is gone. Thomas went somewhere else. Good for him. Thomas would read those really aggressively intellectual books that like kids in college carry around to look smart. He'd be all, oh no, I am reading Hermann Mievel this week. And it wouldn't be because he has a genuine affection for the story of Moby Dick. He just thinks it makes him look clever and means he can get more girls. Elsie, who is now staring at me because I said her name, would be a huge fan of the Anne Bishop Black Jewels books, which are ostensibly very sexy, but I read them all and they have the least sexy erotic sex I have ever encountered. And we had her neutered at a very young age. So she would actually think that that was very sexy and anything that was more graphic or better written would confuse her.
And has she murdered any more birds lately?
For those of you who missed it, so I have a catio, which basically means we've enclosed my porch. It's completely enclosed in wire mesh that has holes in it about yay big. They are tiny little holes. They are not big holes. And I was in the kitchen the other night, and I hear this huge clatter from the catio, and I go rushing out, and there's Elsie with the bird she has just murdered. Now, this is not an outdoor cat. This is not a cat that has ever been hungry in her life, that has ever had an opportunity to go hunting. This bird just wanted to commit suicide by cat, and by God, it succeeded. I think it is very unlikely that any more birds will force their way into the catio, for which I am super grateful, because wild birds carry lots of parasites and diseases, and I don't want my cats exposed to those things.
And they shouldn't be in your catio. That's the whole point.
Right? Like, I took a picture of the dead bird and sent it to Ursula Vernon, who is another author. If you've not encountered her work, she is transcendently lovely. She also writes as T. Kingfisher, and her book, The Twisted Ones, is one of the scariest things I've read in the last 10 years. It really upset me. But she is a bird watcher. She's very good at birds. So I sent her this picture of a dead bird and was like, did Elsie just kill the last baby pileated woodpecker in Washington? And Ursula's like, no, that's a chickadee. It's fine. She can kill 80 of those and it won't make a difference.
Well, let's hope she doesn't. Andrea just started reading your parasitology series and was wondering Don't Go Out Alone. Was it ever created as a standalone book the way Over the Woodward Wall has been? And is there somewhere to read it in whole, if so?
It has been written in whole, but it has not been published as yet. You know, in answer to the question about self-publishing, if I keep not finding a picture book artist, I may eventually just commission the art and do it myself. But I don't have a book printing press, so I'm not certain how I would go about doing that.
Got it. And here's one that I want to actually, this is more of a comment than a question, but it's a question that I have that I want to piggyback onto it from Meg, who says she's read everything you write and she loves the amount of research you put into your work. She especially loves your inclusivity and genuineness. Thank you for not having sexual violence in your writing. She does ask if you have any new series. We'll get to that, but I want to ask about or talk about how good you are at inclusion and diversity in writing your characters. I was thinking about it when I was rereading Into the Drowning Deep with just this effortless, there isn't like, oh, this is the token deaf person and this is the token something else person. How do you go, it's a silly question, how do you go about doing that? But it seems very important to you in your work.
Well, the real world is full of people, as it turns out, And it's not like we're all born and issued a normal person card and a diversity card. You know, I am a neuroatypical, queer, disabled, biracial woman. And not all of that is immediately visible at all times. And not all of that is always relevant to what's going on around me. And none of that defines me 100% of the time. And so it's always been very important to me, as much as possible in my writing, to incorporate people who aren't exactly like me. I do feel like right now in our society, that is an easier effort to make if you are someone who was assigned female at birth, because we have to grow up reading stories about boys. All of the stories, all of the classic children's literature, everything that gets pushed on you is about boys. And, you know, even modern authors, you know, J.K. Rowling freely admits she wrote Harry Potter and the XYZ rather than Hermione Granger and the XYZ because everybody told her it wouldn't sell if it was about a girl. All of my friends who write YA with female protagonists wind up getting told by teachers or librarians, we can't recommend this to the boys. Their parents won't let them. Even if they want to read them, their parents won't let them. And so I think that when you're a girl, you are exposed to this constant stream of people who aren't like you, or when you are assigned to be a girl, even if you're not a girl, you're exposed to this constant stream of people who are not like you, and you have to learn how to identify and empathize with them, because otherwise you don't get any stories. There's nothing there for you. I'm not always as good about it as I want to be. You know, I am a queer person, but I'm a queer person who grew up in art in this society. And this society teaches you a lot of lessons, and they're not all astonishing lessons. They're not all good for you lessons. And it took me a long time to get past the fact that in my head, a happy ending was a guy and a girl. Like, all happy endings were reserved for heterosexual people until I actually had someone call me out on it and sat down and went, oh, wow, all of my happy couples are heterosexual. Like, at that point, I had been with my current girlfriend for years. I came out when I was 14. I would have sworn that I had no homophobia in my body, but I internalized a lot of it from living in this society. And I think all of us have something like that still that is internalized. We have something where we're like, well, I am a fat person and I believe that fat people are worthy of love and adoration. What do you mean this romance novel is about a fat woman? Ew. You know, everyone's got something like that somewhere in them, and we have to just chase it down and burn it out as best we can.
So that actually is a decent segue into J.A.'s question, who appreciates your list of favorite urban fantasy novels on the Tor website. Off the cuff, anything you've read lately that you would recommend as a good comfort read? I don't know why I said it segued nicely. It didn't. Pretend it did.
It depends on what's comforting to you. I mean, The Twisted Ones by T. Kingfisher is horrifying and upsetting, but the way that she puts words in a line is individually very comforting to me, and I find it very kind. Like, her work is not excessively cruel. It's not necessarily my top five on the comfort reads list, but you asked about things I had read recently. I will say that I think A Deadly Education by Naomi Novik, which is coming out later this year, is going to be a comfort read for a lot of people. And I would also like to take this moment to remind you all that Naomi did not invent the concept of the Scholomance. The magical school in Transylvania that is run by the devil is a folkloric concept that stretches back at least as far as the 13th century and may be part of why Dracula was set in that region. She didn't invent the idea. So if you read A Deadly Education and you're like, no, wait, evil Hogwarts, this is genius. I want to play with the Scholomance too. You can. It is a public domain concept. And Naomi Novik founded AO3. So, you know, she wouldn't care about the fanfic of it all. But if you want to write your own Scholomance book and pursue publication, you are not ripping her off unless you steal her exact class structure.
Nice. And I have the art of that and I'm looking forward to it.
Oh my God, it's so good. It made me so angry. Why did I not write my Scholomance book first? Because she's going to get so much credit for coming up with this idea that's been around since the 1300s. Such a book. Oh my God.
It just got bumped up my queue because of this. Thank you.
Good. things I did not read recently that are comfort reads for me. The Last Unicorn will always be a comfort read for me. The first 180 pages of The Stand, weirdly enough, are a comfort read for me. That's when the flu pandemic gets out. It's the circle opens through the circle closes. And King did just such a brilliant job of describing the transmission and spread of this disease. I don't know that I would find it that comforting if I read it for the first time today, but it's something that I read the first time when I was 11. It is a warm hug from an old friend who just wants me to come and see his beautiful influenza pandemic. And then in terms of things that are very comforting to me that might be hard to find, Promised Land by Connie Willis and Cynthia Felice is a frontier romance, a science fiction frontier romance that is just, it is sweet and it has stakes, but the stakes won't kill anybody. And it's very pleasant and I highly recommend it.
Great. And if someone wanted to start reading your books, what would be a good place to start?
If somebody asked that question under normal circumstances, my response would be, what do you already like? Because, you know, I will try to explain books in terms of 101, 401, whatnot. I think that Every Heart a Doorway is accessible to anyone who has grown up in or around this society, because it is very informed by classic portal fantasy, things like Oz and Narnia. So it's going to be accessible to anyone. Middle Game, which I genuinely feel is my best work to date, is more of a 401 book. It is interrogating and playing with higher concept fantasy ideas. And that's not, oh, you're too stupid to read this book. It's just, I'm not sure you would fully enjoy it if you haven't read a lot of fantasy. So I wouldn't necessarily start there. If you've read a lot of urban fantasy, then Rosemary and Rue or Discount Armageddon are both good places to begin. If you haven't, you won't pick up on the tropes of the genre, and that may not be as welcoming as I want it to be. If you like medical science fiction, if you are like me and have watched every episode of Grey's Anatomy, or you enjoyed The West Wing, then Feed by Mira Grant may be the place to go.
Great. Somebody just saw my copy of Kingdom of Needle and Bone in the background. Said the book was brilliant and was so sad it didn't make the Hugo nominees. I hear you're writing another pandemic book. How weird is writing that now?
We've actually trunked that pandemic book because of what came out. Like, the publisher still wants it, but they want it in a couple of years. And we've put the pause on it for now because it was about a respiratory disease. And I did my research very, very well, as anyone who's read Feed and seen the development of Kellis Amberley can attest. So I'm just writing these loving pages of people suffocating on their own lungs while COVID-19 is shutting Disney World and Broadway. And eventually I went to my agent and said, you have to talk to my editor. You have to get me permission to stop writing this book, because I think if we published it according to the original publication date, we would look like insensitive assholes. And when I can avoid looking like an insensitive asshole, that is usually my go-to.
I think that's a fairly smart idea. I mean, I'm not even reading this one right now. I can't.
Like, that's a good choice.
It's there for like maybe next year. What obscure myth or trope would you like to mine that you haven't yet, other than The Skull Man's Deadly Education?
Oh, wow. You know, I am so self-indulgent. Like, I am not a person that really learned the point of moderation. I went to college for a folklore degree just so I could spend years singing Tamlin at anyone who got near me. I wish I had gotten to the Scholomance first, but I didn't really have an idea that fit into the Scholomance setting. So even though I was aware of it, it was never a super focus for me. And when I finished that book, I did promptly call Naomi on the phone and tell her to go fuck herself multiple times. And because she's a fanfic author, she enjoyed that phone call very, very much. I'm just shouting, Naomi, fuck you, over and over. And she's laughing. Because the worst thing about going from fanfic to professional fic is losing that relationship you have with your commenters, where you would put up a new chapter and immediately 20 people are like, oh my God, fuck you forever. And I'm like, that was magic. I missed that. But I can't do that with a Toby book. So I can't really say that right now there are any obscure folkloric things that I am dying to do that I haven't already been like, you know what would be fun? This would be fun. And my agent's like, sure, Shannon. Multiple books about hitchhiking ghosts. That is a thing with an audience.
Well, it seems to be.
Yep.
And we also have someone who's a huge fan of indexing. Do you think you would ever be asked to revisit that universe?
I would love to write more indexing. I love indexing so much. That is literally the series I bought. I wrote to justify an unreasonable purchase because I bought, I think you saw it, Dina, didn't I show you? I bought a copy of the Arne Thompson Index to Motifs in Folklore and Fairy Tales. Mm-hmm. It was $100 for all six volumes, which was the single most expensive book purchase I had ever made. And it was tax deductible because I am a folklorist and an author, but I still wanted to have a reason to have this in my house. So I wrote the indexing books. I would love to continue them, but right now 47 North, which is the publisher, is not publishing any serials. And because of my contracts with Daw and Tor, they pretty much have first look at any novel length things.
Okay.
So I need 47 North to pick up another serial.
Got it. So Sherry says, you mentioned working with marine biologists for Drowning Deep. Do you have tips for getting assistance from experts to make your books about the unbelievable actually believable?
Right now, probably not, because quarantine has changed everything for everyone. But under normal circumstances, scientists love to talk about the science they do. They love the opportunity to help somebody make fiction that is fictional but still truer to life. Like that is scientist Christmas, is when you go to somebody and say, hey, I'm an author of X, I'm writing Y, could you help me? And they will generally answer questions. So check Twitter, look for people that are doing science education, call your local university or library or zoo or aquarium or whatever, and ask if there's anyone that would be willing to speak with you. And as long as you are polite and not being an aggressive ass, there will almost always be someone who is willing to speak with you.
Cool. What's your favorite My Little Pony?
My actual favorite My Little Pony in the entire world is weirdly, and I do mean weirdly, Seashell. And that's a little weird because Seashell is ultra common. She's from year two. She is one of only two sitting pose ponies released in the United States, five released in the entire world. And I love her. This is the original Lushok, y'all. Like, the October Day books are literally a novelization of the 12-year My Little Pony game I played in my bedroom, which was basically Gormenghast with hooves. And because Seashell was always sitting, she couldn't have a lot of the gallopy adventures, so she did stuff with magic. This is the original Sea Witch. I have Seashells from France, Italy, and South Africa. South Africa was very difficult to track down. There are, so far as the My Little Pony collecting community knows, only 8 decent condition South African seashells left in the world. And that pony is part of the reason there's an entire section in my will about my Little Ponies, because the idea of somebody dumping them on a Goodwill has caused me to wake up in a cold sweat.
You've got some suggestions to do Tam Lin, by the way.
I've done Tam Lin. That's what the October Day series is. It's Tam Lin fanfic.
There you go. And then everybody wants to know more indexing stuff, but we're not getting more indexing until somebody publishes or lets her publish more indexing. When Alice Price Healy is a narrator, fingers crossed, will that be concurrent with Imaginary Numbers Duology?
It will not be concurrent, but it will functionally be, like, the perspective of the characters, it will functionally be concurrent, because Alice is not going to have any contact with the family following Follow the Lady until after she has finished her book. Spelunking Through Hell will be coming out in 2022.
Okay. This is my question. Andy's told me we can only have one more question, but I'm going to throw in an extra one.
Andy!
I know, we could keep going. There are still so many questions.
Mean. Okay.
Andy's my boss. He, on tonight, today, he, what he says goes. I've got to find a good one. See, now you're making me. Will we see any more Velveteen books? That's mine.
So this kind of sounds like a I'm going to hold you hostage response, but if you want to see more Velveteen, you have to buy the Velveteen that's already out there, most of which is currently at Borderlands. They were originally published by a micro press that did not realize what it was doing to itself when it took me on, and we overwhelmed their system, and I acknowledge that fact, but I bought the entire remaining stock 2 years ago and have been selling it through Borderlands ever since because I can't afford not to. In order to finish Velveteen Volume 4, I have to be able to find a quote-unquote real publisher that will keep the stories available. I'm not going to be able to do that until the remaining copies of Volumes 1 through 3 are no longer available. No publisher is going to touch it while you can still buy those small press versions. So if you want to see more Velveteen, you need to buy what's already out there as quickly as you can.
Okay. That's pretty much the basic advice for everything. You want more, you have to buy it, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so last question. This is from James. And this is, I'm interested in this because I'm slowly following along. Also, aside from all the other stuff you're doing, you're also doing the Small Gods series, which combines your flash fiction with Lee Moyer's art. How did you connect with Lee and decide to do this?
We are local. We live near each other. And so we've known each other for years. Lee has done several encrypted covers when Ali Fell, who was our original cover artist, was not available to do them. And Lee has been working on the Small Gods series for years and wanted to find somebody that could write them. And he finally just asked me, and I said, sure, you know, we're all a little bored. We got nothing to do.
And this is available online. People can just go and read it, right?
Yep, you can just go and read it. It's on Instagram. It's on Tumblr. There's a Twitter feed. You can just find it. And I am now looking at the other questions because your boss can stop you, but you can't stop me.
Yes. Love Middle
Well, always a fully fledged story, or did you go back and complete it later? I had to write it as I was going because otherwise the excerpts wouldn't make sense. I did wind up editing and refining it later, and I'm very excited that that's actually coming out from tor.com. How is your Animal Crossing island going? Who's your favorite villager? My island is going great. I have terraforming. I'm a little freaked out by all y'all's perfect manicured islands. I did not move to a tropical island to live a Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous life. I just want to chase butterflies and be a feral mud child. My house is completely full of turtles and frogs. It's wonderful. And my favorite villager is Diva. She is my frog queen. We've gotten some great characters with disabilities in your series. Georgia, Nadja, several characters in Into the Drowning Deep. Is there any chance of getting more main characters with disabilities? Yes, absolutely. But it's going to take until I have more books that have new main characters. It is the one problem with being locked into several ongoing series is that, you know, I can't suddenly retroactively make Alex disabled or anything like that. And also a lot of my characters are non-human, which complicates things like neuroatypicalities. I'm never going to say Dodger is autistic. A lot of people have caught that she probably is because she's one of my characters, but she's also a product of terrifying alchemy and not truly human. So it seems very alienating and othering to make that claim. Are you going to get the Ghostbusters My Little Pony? Probably not. I'm not that into it, but I'm definitely getting the Dungeons and Dragons My Little Pony. What is the first stranger bird you ever picked up? The first bird I did not know that we can absolutely confirm I picked up because we have a picture was a Canada goose when I was 5 years old. The goose is almost bigger than I am, and it is adorable. What advice? I'm very good at picking up birds. What advice do you give to writers, especially those of marginalized identities, trying to break into traditional publishing? Advice for getting an agent, etc. You are not as good as you think you are right now. None of us is. I thought I was ready years before I was. You need to write the absolute best book you can. And when I say write it, I mean finish it. You have to have something polished that you think you could sell. Get multiple people to read it who are not your mother. And when every single person who reads it says, this is great, it should be published, now you're ready to go looking for an agent. Look for agents that have stables that resemble yours. If you want to write queer erotica, look for someone like Diana Fox, who publishes, you know, represents queer erotica. If you want to break in with someone that has a strong stable of Asian American authors and will be able to support you in any cultural conflicts, talk to Dong Won Song. You know, look for agents who have authors that kind of fit the identity that is represented by both yourself and your work. You are not obligated to write about your own identity. Nobody gets to make you do that. But if that's what you want to do, find an agent that's already working there. We are, I think, about to see a contraction where it will get harder for new writers and writers of marginalized identities to break in, because the coronavirus has caused us to lose printing presses. It has caused book sales to dramatically drop pretty much across the board. And that is going to affect your ability to get published. But don't give up and don't listen to the assholes. There will always be old white guys who are perfectly happy to tell you that anyone who's not an old white guy is an aberration, and that women only developed talent when Connie Willis was born, and all of this other bullshit, and it's all bullshit. Don't listen to them. Lee Weinstein asks, how did Mira Grant come to be? Marketing, and because I think they're just gonna cut me off very soon, you should go to my website. There's a whole section there in the writing section about why are you Mira Grant? Big fan of the Alien series. I finished and enjoyed Alien Echo. How did that book come to be? They approached me, and where they rather approached my agent and said, do you have an author who would be willing to write us a YA book in the Alien universe? Queer content, welcome. And she was like, Shannon would probably do that for free, but I won't let her. So they did pay me. They did not pay me a lot, but they paid me enough because now I'm a part of the Alien universe, which given the first movie I can remember watching when I was way, way, way too young, made a big impact on me and was very important. Do you write, work another job, or do you write full time? I am fortunate enough to be a full time author and have been for the last 5 years. Can we still purchase a voting membership for the Hugos? Yes, you can. And would that be wonderful? If you were to write a book that does not involve any sort of LGBTQ character, do you think it would be a successful series? That feels a tiny bit like a gotcha right now. If you read the Toby books, you don't actually meet any of the LGBTQ characters until book 4. And that is a very successful series. You know, it's doing great. Also with the Velveteen stuff, you didn't meet any LGBTQ characters until fairly late into the game. I don't think that queer content is actually required. I think that for me, if I were to write a book with no queer content, that would be out of character enough that it would impact my reader reactions. I think if you are a new author starting out and what you want to write is a straight manly book about a straight man doing straight manly things, that still has a very good chance of succeeding. There are huge numbers of books with no queer content at all that still do really, really well. Do I think that that's a realistic view of the world? No. But you do you. I don't get to dictate your books any more than you get to dictate mine. What kind of cat is your mom's kitten? Tinkerbell is a ragdoll. Any chance of us getting any sort of more content set in the world of your latest Patreon story? I need more magical cheese. Not currently. You know, I told the story I wanted to tell, and that usually means that I'm done. I'm checking out. Are there any new Mira Grant books in progress? Not right now, because we tabled the one that involved a huge number of pandemic deaths. You should do a double date story with Toby and Verity. Would you consider doing a crossover with all your characters into one novel? It would be a huge concept to see the in-depth perception of all the characters together. No, because as soon as Georgia shows up, everybody either turns into a zombie or dies. Would you make a steampunk novel series if I had an idea for one that I actually wanted to write? Whose cover slash rendition of Tamlin is your favorite? I am very fond of the Steel Eyes fan version. Any ideas for new indexing stories? Yes, absolutely. How did indexing come about as a Kindle serial? How can we get Amazon to let you write more indexing? They asked me for a serial, and that was the concept that I gave them. And if I knew how to get them to let me write more, I would already be doing it. And will there ever be an audiobook of book 3 of Velveteen? Probably not right now, because the ebook is not available for sale and the book is technically out of print. So it's very unlikely that anyone would be willing to invest in recording an audiobook for something that apparently has no demand. So we're back to sell all the physical books, and then I will be able to get them reprinted with a new publisher and with new material. And I have answered all the questions.
And one more. Would a Hugo victory for a middle game increase the chance for a middle game sequel?
Yes. I mean, the thing about the Hugos, about any award or bestseller list that lets your publisher change your first name, because, you know, my first name, if you look at this closely, is the New York Times best-selling author. And that's going to be my first name forever. But if they can change the title of the book to Hugo Award-winning middle game, the chances of a sequel will go way, way up. Also, if I win a Hugo Award for middle game, because unfortunately Worldcon has had to be canceled thanks to COVID, fuck you, COVID, we are not all going to Wellington, New Zealand this year. And I will be going down into the swamp near my house in my big fancy Hugo dress, and I will then walk out onto the fallen tree that I like to sit on above the river and sit down with my phone and be watching the Hugo live stream from the swamp. And if I win, when I go live for the Hugo acceptance, I will say thank you very much, and then I will gently put my phone down and fall backward into the river in my giant Hugo dress. So if you want to see that happen, if you want to see a woman in a dress that weighs almost as much as she does, go diving, vote for Middle Game.
And go buy your voting membership.
And thank you so much for supporting the Free Library of Philadelphia, which has been wonderful, and for supporting Borderlands through the links at the bottom of the screen.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Shannon, so much for joining us tonight. Next time in person. To all our viewers at home, be sure to follow us on Crowdcast and visit us online at freelibrary.org/author events to access our digital archives and updated event schedule. Thanks, everyone.
Keep reading. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.